You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 19th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, why do Donald Trump's rivals for the Republican nomination appear to be the last people on earth willing to call the thick, nasty, weirdly orange blowhard a thick, nasty, weirdly orange blowhard? My guests Ivor Gaber and Michael Goldfarb will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including sleepless in Brussels as the rest of the EU struggles to decide how much it cares whether or not the UK remains a member. The questions posed by Yahoo's axing of its stable of digital magazines, not the least of which is, who knew that Yahoo had a stable of digital magazines? And why does Apple think that writing privacy laws is somehow its department? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And you are welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism, and Michael Goldfarb, the author and journalist and commentator, etc. Welcome both back to Midori House. We will start with Donald Trump, because however many times one reads, says or considers that Donald Trump, of all people, is the bookie's favourite to lead the party of Lincoln, Grant, Teddy Roosevelt and Eisenhower into a presidential election, it never gets less bewildering. Trump's flaws are legion and obvious, but to run through them one more time. He is a dim, charmless, cynical, humourless, willfully ignorant buffoon and bully. The obvious question being, why aren't his remaining opponents pointing this out? Well, writing in the Daily Beast, former Mitt Romney adviser Stuart Stevens suggests doing exactly that. Michael Goldfarb, is it just that if you're going to set about criticising Donald Trump, it's quite difficult to know where to start?
No, it's to do with, because of the way he's sort of like, if you had a midget football team and you brought on Leo Messi and he starts doing his thing, then and
I'm on Donald Trump is no Lionel Messi as no to misquote somebody.
Let me finish this profound analogy. if you brought on, I mean, he would run rings on these guys. Aren't they've spent their entire lives in politics learning how to trim, hold back. I mean, their every professional instinct is to squash down their id. And then they meet this guy, Donald Trump. If, say, Jeb Bush did what I'm certain he wants to do, which is like walk across the stage at one of these debates, haul off and clock him one, it wouldn't work because Jeb Bush did it. And the thing is that you saw yesterday, you know, Pope Francis probably was speaking from the heart, but was ill-advised to single out Donald Trump to say he's not Christian. He could say some of the policies being discussed about throwing out immigrants from the U.S. is not behaving in a Christian way. That would have been fine. But he gets to the ring with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump, within half an hour, had actually a very good response to that, and playing to his base, saying, well, the Vatican has walls all around it. But I tell you what, if ISIS comes to the Vatican, and remember, they are trying to overthrow Christianity, which in fact is part of the ISIS political project, I will come and make sure that the Pope is rescued. You cannot get into the ring with him unless you've got lots of practice.
It's that old, I guess, adage that one shouldn't wrestle in mud with a pig because you both get filthy and the pig doesn't care. Ivor, is there also a problem that if you merely point out that Donald Trump is stupid, which he is, that it makes him more popular, it encourages his supporters to rally round him even more volubly?
Well, I just to be briefly serious, I think there is a real problem. As somebody who studied political communication, the problem is if there's somebody who's got the gift of communicating with, quote, ordinary people, and they respond and he touches a nerve, and then you start calling him stupid, they, by implication, take it that you're calling them stupid as well.
Indeed so.
And I think you get a real backlash. So I think, I do like the idea of Jeb Bush clocking him, but I'm not sure that would be totally successful. I do think there is a problem of opposing him. It's a bit like Nigel Farage, who is the leader of the British UK Independence Party, anti-Europe party. He's very good on television because he's got very simple saloon bar solutions to every problem. And that's the difficulty. difficulty with arguing with somebody who has.
Again, I'm paraphrasing H.L. Mencken, I'm sure, badly, but yes, to every problem there is a solution that is simple, easy, and wrong. and Donald Trump does rather specialise in them. Michael Goldfarb, Stuart Stevens' piece in the Daily Beast did have a couple of fairly obvious lines of attack, apart from pointing out that Donald Trump is, you know, just an ignorant blowhard, just pointing out as well that he is about as New York liberal establishment as it gets.
Well, the problem for people like Stuart Stevens, who's a professional political advisor, as you mentioned, he was helping Mitt Romney in his wildly unsuccessful attempt to unseat Barack Obama, is that, as I've said here on Midori House and recently, Donald Trump is not the Pied Piper. He has not created this constituency. It existed. He is simply giving it voice. And it is absolutely remarkable that no one has managed to notice. I mean, in South Carolina, where I was recently reporting on Trump, I actually, in exasperation to a couple of supporters, said, but he's a Yankee. He's from up north. This is South Carolina, where the Civil War began. And they said, we don't care. We think he's not of Washington. And these were intelligent men, by the way. He's not from Washington. He has no connections in Washington. Not true. But he has no connections to Washington, to the political establishment. He will do what we want, which is to clean out, as they said, the raccoons who are gnawing away at the basement of American democracy.
Ivor, the piece by Stuart Stephen also suggested making more hay of Donald Trump's extraordinary sensitivity to criticism and to render him ridiculous by basically, or one should say more ridiculous, by agitating him into a state of more or less constant tantrum. Would that eventually play against him?
There was one very good line, which I'm sure, in that piece, which I'm sure would drive him spare, which was, had you taken the money that he inherited at birth and simply invested in stocks and shares, he would have been wealthier than he is now with all his fantastic business dealings, a man with, I think, 4 bankruptcies to his name. That really gets his goat, because the one thing he thinks he knows about is business. There is, it seems to me, you're absolutely right, a need to try and find that sensitive spot.
But he's covered in them. You know, he does swing at absolutely every pitch.
But nobody's really taken him on and said, you're a fraud. You're a fraud.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think there are they have, and in so many, but not in so direct language, because they are stuck with, as I say, being professional politicians. The one person who's been slightly aggressive is Ted Cruz. But to just go back to the point I made earlier, they'll be voting in South Carolina over the weekend in the Republican primary. And the latest poll shows Donald Trump on 28% of the vote and Ted Cruz, who's equally as outrageous and in fact is probably running in the shadow of enormous outrage from Trump.
Indeed,
is on 23%. I can add those two together. I get 51%, meaning more than half the Republican electorate in South Carolina more or less agrees that 11 million people can be easily deported back to Mexico, that you can drop nuclear bombs all over the Arab and Muslim Middle East and so on. And that is, to me, much more astonishing than the fact that Donald Trump is continuing his life as both an entertainer and neophyte politician.
Well, on that happy thought, and we will doubtless have ample opportunity to return to this one, we will look now towards Brussels, where British Prime Minister David Cameron is still attempting to negotiate a deal he can present to his country ahead of an EU membership referendum due this year. Talks went on last night until nearly breakfast time and have been continuing all day, which means the future of the continent is now being decided by people who feel like you do after an overnight flight in economy class. As we go to air, no final text had yet emerged. Ivor, first of all, you and I and Michael were actually bickering about this before we came to air.
We were discussing it. We don't bicker.
Discussing it, then. Does any of this matter anyway? Because this is going to be a referendum in this country on immigration, isn't it?
More or less. I think it's going to be a bit more than that, because I think that's going to be a big emotional factor. But I do think, he says, sticking his head above the parapet in a way that serious pundits never should, that when push comes to shove, people are going to try and take an economic decision. The fear factor. You know, that is it Is it the plunge into the unknown or stay with nurse for fear of something worse, as public school people are meant to say? And so I think that the migration is a big factor, but I think the people make calculations about whether they are and their family are going to be better or worse off, and I think it's very difficult to call.
Michael, what sense do you get of the balance the EU is trying to strike between obviously wanting to keep the UK in and also wanting not to give every other country a license to threaten to quit when it doesn't get its own way?
Yeah, well, I think that they are doing what they can. It's very clear from everything that's been said in public and from what one reads unattributed spokespeople saying from Brussels is that Germany doesn't want to see the UK leave, for sure. And, you know, the interesting thing is that a year or two ago, when this first began to hove into sight, you might actually have thought that a lot of people said, you know what, if the UK wants to, if the Brits want to go, they should go. But when you factor in the lingering problems of the Eurozone, and the drag on the European economy that the Greek crisis continues to exert, and you throw in this massive migration out of Syria and Iraq to...
None of which is going to stop this summer.
This has created a phenomenal air of crisis. And the last thing that the EU's... That Germany wants, and for that matter, France, who are the ones dragging their heels at the moment, is what we're hearing. The last thing they want is for the third big country to pull out at this moment. So a year or two ago, they might have said, well, tant pis, and now they have to say, well, we can't have it. So they'll do what they can necessarily. But, you know, here's what I find fascinating is that all of our colleagues are over there, sleepless nights, and I do feel for them. I've had one or two sleepless nights on account of EU negotiations myself, and, you know, better them than me.
I'm just boggling a bit at the idea of EU negotiations keeping people awake. I would have thought they would have had the opposite effect.
Well, that's what the 24-hour news cycle does. You got to file updates at 2 a.m. But in the end, everything that's done there is actually sort of irrelevant. You were saying immigration will be the decision. I think that people have been arguing about Britain's membership and arguing intensely in this country since I got here, and that was 30 years ago. You know, Margaret Thatcher was a very reluctant European, and the Conservative Party remains utterly riven about, you know, membership, and the conservative-leaning newspapers in this country have so muddied the well. Whatever David Cameron brings back, you can be sure that the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph and probably the Times are all going to say this is a waste. What a waste. And this
but
was...
But they'll probably all vote to stay, campaign to stay in anyway.
Do you think? I would have said that I would have said that a year ago, but now I'm not so sure. Certainly, The Sun is campaigning in such a way it'd be difficult to see them turning around.
The Sun is past master at turning its guns around very quickly.
And the Daily Mail, they're both campaigning with such vigour and bitterness. I see it quite difficult for them to turn around. So I have a concern. As a Europhile, as a European, I'm very concerned that whereas a year ago I thought, well, don't worry, the British media will come and save us all, I'm now not so sure. And I think we're now in uncharted waters.
And I think people are beyond... I think the well has been poisoned so thoroughly. I mean, if you go back to last spring's election, general election here in the UK, and you look at a couple of million lifelong Labour voters followed Nigel Farage and voted UKIP, that kind of change of mind takes a long time to reach, and once people reach it, you're not going to pull them back. People have conflated the uncertain economic circumstances, the lack of full-time employment in many parts of Britain, something we don't talk about because London booms and is glittering and is overcrowded. And, you know, they do see, you know, here's these Polish guys, they've come over and they're all working and their kids are in school and they're getting benefits, and you're not going to pull them away. Some small concession. We're not going to have an intellectual discussion about that in the saloon bar in a pub in Middlesbrough.
No, sure. I'm sure you're right. I've a final thought on this. We should look at the likely or possible effects this will have on British politics. The idea is that if David Cameron ever does come back from Brussels and doesn't spend the rest of his life there trying to negotiate some sort of deal, that will be the beginning of the campaign. His cabinet will be at liberty to take whichever side they so choose. How ugly could that get? Because we are in a weird state in British politics where we have an opposition such as it is in a fairly advanced state of entrenched civil conflict. Could we end up with a ruling party in more or less the same state? As you point out, this has been the thing the Tories have argued about amongst themselves for, you know, ever.
I think we're in very strange times in British politics. One, as you say, the Labour Party is facing an existential crisis, having elected a leader who is far more left-wing than anything they've ever had before. The Tories are riven. If David Cameron loses this, his legacy is dead, and he said he's stepping down anyway, and they could collapse, split. The Liberal Party that we have here is disappeared, and ironically, UKIP will die because they will have lost their raison d'etre. You know, they were campaigning for a referendum. If it's won, they have no role. And if it's lost, they'll collapse anyway. So I think we could see the end of the party system. I joke, but we are in very difficult water, very difficult to predict how it's going to be. And certainly it's going to be... I'm reminded of Harold Macmillan, a former British Prime Minister, who when asked what kept him awake at night, said, "Events, dear boy, events." And this is an event.
One of the wisest of all political wisdoms, that one. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Ivor Gaber and Michael Goldfarb. Coming up next, is the future of publishing really digital?
Monocle Films celebrates the publication of our latest travel guide with a cinematic ode to Rio de Janeiro. We explore this city full of surprises to show that Rio's beauty is not just skin deep.
Few cities have married themselves to the landscape quite like Rio de Janeiro. It's no wonder Rio's architects and designers have been inspired by its undulating tropical topography since the city was founded. Giants of Brazilian architecture have left their mark here, and Brazilian designers have put Rio firmly on the map too.
The Monocle Travel Guide to Rio, a filmic sampler now showing in the film section of monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Michael Goldfarb and Ivor Gaber. Now, here in the UK, media circles have been preoccupied these last couple of weeks by the closure of the print editions of The Independent and The Independent on Sunday. The newspaper's proprietors continue to insist that they are merely bowing to commercial logic and fully embracing the digital future. But if the future is indeed digital, why has Yahoo, one of the digital pioneers, closed several of its online magazines, including Yahoo Travel, Yahoo Parenting, Yahoo Autos, and Yahoo Real Estate? Ivor, first of all, professor of journalism that you are, is the fact that today, upon being briefed that we were doing this story in the programme, is the very first I've ever heard of any of these titles in some way indicative of the problem Yahoo had?
Well, possibly it might also be that you're not the target market, since I understand they're mostly lifestyle things, and being a radio presenter, you have no lifestyle to talk of, and nor do I. But I was unaware that Yahoo had a range of magazines, but I do think we're, to reflect the previous conversation, we're in very odd times with people thrashing around. I mean, the big problem remains, whether it's lifestyle magazines or news, who's going to pay for it? And we haven't resolved that question, and we've discussed that in this studio and elsewhere. And until we resolve that question, if it can be resolved, we're going to see digital companies going into print, print companies going into digital, and so on and so forth. And we're all racing around and trying to work out what the next move should be.
Michael, were you a regular reader of any of Yahoo's digital offerings?
No, because I don't use Yahoo. I mean, this is the thing.
I think we're beginning to isolate what went wrong.
Well, but what went wrong with Yahoo is that a company that was one of the original search engines and built its brand recognition and its traffic through search, and then offering, emails, an email account and so on, has lost the great battle to Google and is now thrashing around trying to figure out what it is. somewhere in this constantly being reinvented new world, there was a moment where if you were going to have a lot of people coming through your portal, you therefore needed to offer them some content. And, you know, they had these choices and, you know, I don't even know whether it was all, you know, stolen from elsewhere or was original. I have no idea. AOL did the same thing. They paid $300 million some years ago for the Huffington Post. Well, the Huffington Post continues, although there's a bit of a kerfuffle here in town because yesterday the UK head of the Huffington Post said his journalism was great because he doesn't pay his reporters.
Yes.
They do the stories because they want to do it.
I have the quote written down here. He said of unpaid writing that we know it's real. One could argue that a lot of what the Huffington Post publishes is real, unsubbed, unpaid for, really quite badly written, not very good. The consequence of what one gets when one pays peanuts. One could argue that
exactly, and yet it still gets more traffic because at least it's reliable. It has a persona, and it's meant to be a liberal sheet. People put stuff up and then tell all their friends to go and look, and they keep traffic going and so on. And they do. It is true. They have a handful of paid staff in Washington and a handful of paid staff here in London. Okay. That was what AOL did. They said, we have to compete with Yahoo and have magazines. We have to offer content. But will any of that survive? And I would have to say no, because what people use their search engines for and use their email accounts are to send emails, and they don't need to be distracted. There's plenty of other places to be distracted.
But there are some digital news operations that I'm aware of that do seem to be thriving. BuzzFeed is the classic one.
Yeah, but BuzzFeed, that's its brand. It started out as a gossip site, and now they've built a really tight and, I must say, excellent foreign operation, and they break news.
And they're British. They've hired a lot of investigative reporters, political reporters. They do have some ads, but I'm still not quite sure how they're being paid for. I think they're still being
subsidized. Well, they're burning through venture capital. I mean, the thing is that a lot of these, I mean, look at Vice. We all have our moments with Vice. Sometimes they do amazing stuff. Most of the time they don't. But when you get $500 million from two or three major investors, including HBO and Rupert Murdoch, you don't have to worry about how you survive. You know, you have a cushion. At some point, I imagine one of these places will crack a code in how you can make money from advertising on this, because I don't see how they can ever charge. I mean, perhaps HBO, you know, through the HBO deal, Vice programming, you have to pay to see it. But I mean, the news stuff is, I mean, it's too late to put news back for these guys behind a paywall. So they're going to have to figure out a way to make sure that their ad rates pay for the reporters, but only after they've burned through all of the startup money.
I have a final thought from you on this, because another media story that broke this week was another thumping, record-breaking rise in circulation for Private Eye, the British satirical investigative magazine, which has largely disdained the online world and continues to put on readers. The Spectator, New Statesman, also good times for them.
Prospect magazine.
Prospect, The Economist. Is there still something in print, not necessarily as a daily thing, but maybe as a weekly thing?
I think you've just put your finger on it, Andrew. I think you're probably about to make your fortune, because I do think us old fogies who say, I like my morning paper over my breakfast, are clearly passé. But the idea of tucking a magazine into your briefcase and then taking it out foot up when you've got a spare 10 minutes, I think it's beginning to work. And you're absolutely right. I mean, Private Eye's website is a joke, but they do that deliberately,
yeah,
because they don't want it. And it's a scruffily produced magazine, and 80% of its content is untrue. The problem is we don't know which 80% that is. But it works. And as you said, fantastic. Oh, almost. Well, they sell more than The Economist does, which of course, but The Economist has got a fantastic worldwide distribution. So, yep, I think Yahoo have got it right if they're going to take their magazines off digital and make them print. But yeah, the future for the weeklies and the monthlies is print.
Well, we'll stay with tech news finally, because Apple has been fighting on two fronts this week, one with its customers over an iPhone trick that disabled the phones if serviced by a non-Apple technician, the other with the feds over the FBI's demand that Apple help it access the phone, or help the FBI rather, access the phone of the late San Bernardino gunman Syed Rizwan Farooq, who killed 14 people in a shooting spree last December. Either, first of all, with the iPhone thing, Apple has apologised, they've released a fix, they said it was only ever intended as a factory test. Does that all sound fair enough?
To misquote a famous witness in Britain, they would say that, wouldn't they? I mean, they have been caught doing what big corporations do, and we usually don't catch them, doing dirty tricks to increase their profits at the expense of consumers. It was outrageous what they were doing. I suppose I should tread with care. It's outrageous what it was alleged they were doing of disabling people's phones when they had a third party, a non-Apple repairer repair their phones. And I think it's the power of social media, actually, which so quickly forced Apple into retreat when customers were outraged. I think the FBI problem is more complex and difficult, and it's less black and white. But here I think this is black and white, and all credit to Apple, he says, hastily covering his tracks. They've put their hands up, said they made a mistake, and they've offered to fix it with software uploads.
Michael, we'll move on to the curious case of Syed Rizwan Farooq and his phone, because the more I read about this, the more I wonder if I'm missing something fundamental. One, the guy is dead. Two, it's not actually his telephone. It belonged to his employers at San Bernardino County. And three, one would have assumed no one would have any problem with the Fed searching his house. Why is there a thing here?
Well, I think this is... I've read everything that's come out today, and I know nothing about tech. I use it, but I try to avoid too much detailed knowledge, because that way madness lies. I mean, Ivor was explaining to me before we came on the air exactly what the problem was with your thumbprint, and then anyway. So now we're going to talk about geopolitics. The thing is that there's something missing in all the articles I've seen. All the people I follow and read and rely on for explanations of the intersection of tech and politics and tech and geopolitics say that Tim Cook is doing a very brave and correct thing. So, and I read the articles and I'm trying to figure out what's missing. And I think that what's missing is that what is required in order to unlock this phone would compromise the security of everyone's iPhone.
Apple says.
And what they're implying, but not saying directly, is we do not trust the U.S. government to be able to keep whatever code we give them secret. I mean, no, I'm just surmising, by the way. I have no way of knowing, because otherwise it seems a very simple thing. I mean, if the federal government comes to you and says, We only have records for this guy's phone up to a month before he committed the crime and killed these 14 people in San Bernardino. He was radicalized in that, you know, very quickly, and then went to work on it. We need to see what's in his phone. They could issue a subpoena. And I don't see why Apple would say no, except that there is this sentence which has not been written in any article I've read today, and by some very, very sophisticated tech writers, that explains why this code cannot be written in this one single case of national security.
Ivor, do Apple have a point?
In theory, they do. Whether they do in practice, I don't know. I do think that the Snowden revelations suggest that we have to be a little wary of giving governments, particularly the US and the UK government, carte blanche to investigate everything. I do understand if you're not doing bad things, you've got nothing to hide. But history suggests that governments and large organisations give an inch, they'll take a mile. I'm wary of falling in behind the great crusade led by Apple, Google and so forth, because in general, I think they're pretty rotten organisations in terms of their attitude to the public. And, you know, one thinks of tax and other things. But nonetheless, I think there is a big issue there. And if Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton both agree that this is a difficult issue, I'll agree with that.
We will have to leave it there. Ivor Gaber and Michael Goldfarb, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland. Research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, there's music on our Atlantic shift, and The Daily is in with more of the latest news, hopefully from Europe even, if they get a result at 2200 tonight. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good weekend.